This book has been wildly popular. So not only do you feel it's an urgent message, do I feel it's a great book, but readers have really connected with it and have been really kind of snatching it up in a way that doesn't always happen with important books. When you wrote this, you wrote this knowing that you had been diagnosed with cancer yourself, because it's in the introduction.
Yes.
So at least at some point before publication, you had, but you had no idea at that point what was going to happen next.
No.
In your life.
No.
Did you think about that sort of, that combination that you would talk?
Isn't that funny? I mean, I started out writing the book just before the diagnosis. And I was putting together essays and sort of my outline of what I was going to say, because one of the family physicians at our clinic came up to me one day and said, "You got to write a book for those of us who have to care for aging parents." And so that's the beginning. And I'm writing this book, and it has to do with, you know, how to stay young and healthy, how to avoid the pitfalls of aging. And by the way, we're going to all die. And I had two chapters kind of outlined already about accepting the death of a loved one, and then the last chapter, accepting your own death. And then I come down with pancreatic cancer. And I can tell you that it changed the last chapter.
Right.
And one of the interesting things was early on, I met with a good friend of mine who is a pretty famous author himself, V.J. Smith from SCSU. And he said, "Well, Rick, knowing your diagnosis, I can tell you all these things that you should do, but I think the most important thing is get her done. Get her done before you're gone. I mean, get this book going." Yeah. And so I did. I put it in full speed and worked hard at it, right. Got her done.
Once you had your own, because let's go back a little bit before we go forward, one of the reasons that you wanted to say in this book, "Hey, we're all going to die and it's time to deal with," was for physicians and for care and for people who you maybe the fear, their own fear of death, their own dread, their own panic about end of life issues might influence how they give care to others.
Well, that's really true. I mean, if you're walking in another person's moccasins, you know, and that walk has to do with facing your own dying process, that's better than if you're a person who's advising somebody who's a million miles away and they've got a problem that you'll never face. So I think physicians and caregivers need to face their own death and to escape the fear, because I think fearing death, and of course I think it's a universal thing, but I think fearing death is dangerous to your health. It can be harmful, and I've seen it happen. I've seen people run with panic and craze away from their own cancer and away from decent treatment that is effective, and then dying young and miserable because of their fear. You know, I think we are built to have fear to warn us that there's danger. But when the fear becomes panic and overwhelms you, and you're all you're looking at in your life is yourself, self, 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 you lose the reality that it's not about you. That really meaning comes to life when you realize it is not just about me. It's about Lori and Dave and Tom and Cheryl. You know, we've got to open our heart to the reality of other people's happiness. Mm-hmm. And then it isn't money that makes you happy. It is connecting and seeing other people and being with people and enjoying their joy.
Nobody ever, you know, recommended I become a doctor, but I would say that would be one of the better parts of being a doctor, would be that, I would think, that human connection. If you take that away, you're also sort of discouraging people to do one of those things that many of them got into medicine for in the first place.
Right. You know, they say that medicine is a jealous mistress. And what'll happen is a doctor can get involved, and then they are so involved, and it eats their life up that they don't have enough time with their families. And that's probably true. You've got to give them those times. But why would a guy or a gal be eaten up by this? Well, it's because there's so much reward in the connection that you develop with your patients. So it's been a rewarding life. I've had a fabulous time with all of the connection, many of whom are long gone now. You know, as a geriatrician, you know, as an intern, I should take care of old people. And then they die. And you have to say goodbye to them. My whole life has really been preparing for this book, because the book is how to care for elderly people and how to reach that level with ease and with grace and with energy and with gusto. And chapter one is all about exercise and eating right and connecting. And there's a lot in the book. You know, it's kind of a potpourri.
And these wonderful essays are in here, which is clearly my favorite part. Because you have been writing essays and speaking those essays on Call to Prairie Doc for so long, you have something to read for us today, would you?
I could do the one about God, or I could do the one about how important writing is.
We'll do both. Let's start with God. We should always start with God, right?
Okay, start with God. Let's see if I can find it. It should be right there. No, it's not there. Just a minute. It should be. I've got too much on my computer right now. Here it is. Right. Oop, not there. Writing as therapy. Where did my? Okay, it's got to be in this line. I'm almost there. I'm almost there. Listening to God. How do any of us cope with the catastrophes of life? Years ago, a couple faced the tragedy of an accidental death of their only young child. Even though most marriages don't survive such an insult, this one did. Makes me want to cry because I watched it happen. Between the woman and man, there was love, forgiveness, and plenty of help from the people of their church. The people of the congregation, like the wings of a mother hen, surrounded the couple with support, comfort, and warmth. Some critics of organized religion say that we are hardwired to believe in God. They say that it explains why religion exists, but not that God exists. They also point out that no society has survived more than three generations without a religious foundation, including a belief in prayer, the afterlife, and rituals. But, they say, just because we need God doesn't mean that God exists. I contend that the opposite is true, and am reassured of God's presence by the fact that we were designed to believe in God, and there are many more reasons than that to believe God exists. I'm reassured of God's presence when watching a religious-based rehabilitation program successfully help men find their way back from drug and alcohol abuse in Brookings Teen Challenge, for example. The leaders will fill a mentor's role, teach, it's not about you, it is about loving others and loving God. I am reassured of God's presence when studying the wonderful complexity of the human heart and the way the heart muscle, valves, and arteries interact while sending blood with oxygen and nutrition to every cell in the body. I am reassured of God's presence when one hopeful spirit chorale sings and brings spiritual connection to the hearts and the minds and the tears to the eyes of those listening and singing. I am reassured of God's presence when a church or a mosque or a synagogue full of people saying the Lord's Prayer or any prayer in unison vibrates in synchrony with the souls of the congregation. I'm reassured of God's presence when watching a flock of birds or a school of fish move together and then change direction as if one organism, in sync by some ancient and holy spirit. As a medical doctor caring for people through the years, I have had to rely on science
with which to try to help resolve the health problems people face. In caring for people, especially at the end of their lives, I've realized that often science is simply not enough. There's another place to where people need to go to help when the end is near. The spiritual realm, in my view, is all around us. If we listen very carefully for it, and this divine essence provides for many great meaning and help, we need to acknowledge the power outside of our scientific thinking. In one famous interview of Mother Teresa, the interviewer asked her how she prays. "I listen," was her response. "Well, what does God say in return?" was the next question. "He listens," was the response.
Dr. Rick Holm, reading for us today. Thank you for that. Your faith is incredibly important on your own journey, as well as long as well as your journey as a professional, your personal journey.
Yeah. And I can't say that my faith fits anybody else's faith. It's really kind of your own. It's a personal thing. I think everybody has to have their own personal faith, and they have to find it. And if we live in a real world that's and we're honest with ourselves, it's always questioning. And, of course, our church gives us a foundation. But sometimes the churches fail us, and they go in a direction that is not where I would go. It doesn't mean you dump the church. You know, you just kind of know that you can't satisfy everybody. And I just encourage everybody to find a faith that's closest to their own personal faith. And stay with it. The love that family had from the church and their community, outside the church too, was so important in surviving. I mean, when I lost my sister I was 16, she was 19. The family, the church, the community helped me through it. And I think I would wish everybody has that kind of connection. I think we don't emphasize connection as much as we seem to dwell on their policies and procedures and all that baloney that's not so important, really, and not the biggest part of what church is.
Have you reached sort of Mother Teresa-like status in prayer? If I asked you, how do you pray, would your answer be, I listen?
My prayers have changed through the decades. And I used to combine self-hypnosis with making myself better and asking God to give me direction. And then I got into a phase in my life where it was too much like what my parents wanted, and I just dumped the whole thing. And then I realized my heart became shallow without those introspective and listening prayers, actually. And I started praying again. And now I can't say that I pray every night before I go to bed, but I pray multiple times kind of through the day in a meditatory, please help these people. So that's where I'm at right now with those kinds of things.
I want to talk a little bit about some of these end-of-life conversations, be they spiritual or with your wishes. And you're giving a presentation in November.
Yes.
And you have some questions that we can kind of go through, not to make you, you know, move around in your laptop there too much.
No.
But I think they're really valuable for people to think, not just, you know, read the book and start having these conversations, but what actually happens in some of those moments when people are facing some of those decisions, times of stress.
Right. Well, look, we're many boomers, and even the people who are older than the boomers, you know, those people in their mid-70s to through 80s and 90s, they are coming to the time where they absolutely need an advanced directive. And of the questions that they should answer, the most important, I think, is, if I'm not aware of what's going on and it doesn't look like I have a reasonable chance of recovery, do I want a feeding tube or not? I can't say that enough, because unfortunately in our society, feeding tubes are put in, and you will drag a person through a great deal of suffering with that. When and not to say that all feeding tubes are inappropriate, many are, but that many, many, many are not. And they are dragged through suffering with a feeding tube in the nose, not knowing what's going on in a nursing home for another year or two or three. And so I think urgent message is to make a living will. So the first question is, the living will, written, signed, and notarized, is more effective than just discussing one's end-of-life wishes with your family, true or false? And the answer is, well, I'm going to ask the second question first. Imagine this situation. A patient comes into the emergency room in extremis, where the doctor in the ER is aware of an advance directive that says do not resuscitate. If the family is unanimously or even split wanting resuscitation, will the doctor do resuscitation or not do resuscitation? And the answer is, most of the time she is gonna do resuscitation. And so it isn't a great document. Even if you notarized it, they made it with a lawyer. What's important is that your family hears it from you and you look at them and say, you know, it's time, don't do resuscitation. Or it's time not to put a feeding tube in if I don't know what's going on. Because that's a question that, you know, they come in with a stroke and immediately a feeding tube is placed in. Well, wrong. You know, early on, you don't want edema up there, so let them dry out a little bit. Give them 2 or 3 days. Well, the family can have 2 or 3 days of realizing this is where grandpa's going to be, and it isn't pretty, and it wouldn't be what he wanted. So I think it's really important to realize the most important thing a living will is, it's a tool for discussion with your family. And it doesn't work as well as a document than it does as a tool for discussion. Is that pretty clear?
Yes, and that can be hard to hear when your parents say to you, this is what I want, because it's not what you want.
That's right.
But you're younger than they are, so you're making what you think you would want at a different stage in life.
You're 35 years of age, and your parent is dying, and you're filled with fear of death.
Yeah.
And you don't want to have dad die. And so do everything, doctor. Put in those feeding tubes. You know, keep him IV fluid filled and shock him if he goes into CPR. And what a mistake that is.
Yeah. This is different. How is this different from some of the other, you know, my brother, I don't think it's a big secret, has his own cancer journey right now. And we kind of call him the million dollar man, because as soon as he runs out of options, lo and behold, another option comes. So he just, you know, the cancer.
He's dancing the lily pads.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And we're all unanimous and keep jumping to that next lily pad.
Yeah.
Hang on, because 6 months from now, they're going to come up with something else. And that's going to be the thing. He's in his early 50s. He is all in for, you know,
everything.
Like, but this is not a conversation about a feeding tube. It's not a conversation about, you know, a respirator or a nursing home.
Yeah.
People need to make that distinction, don't they? Between the extraordinary methods that we have to treat something versus what is essentially end of life decision.
Yes.
We may have to make those decisions with him. We've talked about that, but we're not there yet.
Yes.
Talk a little bit about that, about some of the other things that, I mean, you've had some miraculous.
I'm dancing on a lily pad right now. I mean, I'm taking immunotherapy. It's made my mouth real sensitive and my anus sensitive. I can say that because I'm a doctor, you know. And I'm numb in my hands and my feet and I'm tired. But by golly, I think something's happening in there that's good.
Yeah.
You know, I feel tumor breaking down, at least in my hope and my imagination, everything.
Yeah.
But boy, if I have a cardiac arrest, don't come near me. So let me go. You know, I'm not afraid of dying, and a cardiac arrest is a nice way to go. Why would you take that away when there's this big, big, huge chance that you're going to have an end of life, that there's going to be suffering and pain?
Yeah.
And I'm aware of the suffering and pain risk. I am not afraid of it either. But I'm the medical director of our hospice in Brookings. I looked at them all last week and I said at our weekly meeting. And when they're in suffering, do not hold back and don't delay and don't let road blocks that can occur, you know? Give that person, or me, please, give me that. Get that pain medicine to me. A person had, there was no order for it in the pharmacy. They couldn't get the fentanyl patch to the patient, and the patient suffered for a full day before they were able to get the pain medicine that the patient needed. And I said, not acceptable. So, there's a difference when it is that end of lifetime. And I mean, there's also a time when they said to me, do I want more chemotherapy? I said, no, more chemotherapy. I've been through the best chemos that they have for this particular cancer. And we've got an option of immunotherapy. Let's go there. But if there were no other options, I would have probably opted for some chemo for my wife's sake until it was causing too much suffering. And then I would say, quit.
Yeah.
And then they would.
Making those decisions is a huge part of this conversation. Who gets to make those decisions?
Yeah.
And why do you make them, and what kind of foundation are you making them from?
Yes.
Your faith, your belief in science, your understanding of the facts, and the fact that it's not, even this most personal thing of all, is not just about you.
No, it isn't just about me. You're right. Yeah. It's also about my family.
Yeah.
And so you make those decisions in accordance with their needs as well.
Yeah.
Until its suffering is too much.
All right, let's go and have some more questions, because one of the things about this book is you have a chapter with some facts and information, diagrams, photos, then you have some questions and an essay. So let's talk about some more questions. We were kind of on. Where do you want to go next?
Yeah. Most people older than 65, which is 15% of the population, and it's rising, have a living will, true or false?
True.
No, false. So the answer is this.
I was optimistic there. I was hopeful.
Hopeful.
For, yeah.
Published in the July 2017 issue of Health Affairs, researchers reviewed 150 studies published between 2011 and 16 that looks at the proportion of adults who completed advanced directives. And of all the adults, of course, if you're, your ability to make a decision about end of life, at 18. Of all the adults, only 37% of the U.S. population had an advanced directive of any kind, compared to 47% of those older than 65 years of age. That's not most. 47% is on the least side. So, I mean, that's still, that's 47%. We didn't have 47% before. So it's climbing. I just hope the boomers, who are spoiled, always get what they want, have demanded everything through their lives. I mean, am I wrong? That's what we are, boomers. We have pretty much, raised in boomer high, the perfect life. Along comes Vietnam. We fought against it. With our mothers who were supporting women's lib, we brought the world to stop Vietnam. I mean, it was us who did that. Now, of course, now 80% of the world's money is in the hands of boomers, and we want what we want and get what we want. And what are we gonna do in the end? My bet is, we won't have that advanced directive. And many of us will be in the nursing home for months with a feeding tube. Or that's my fear. Please don't let that happen. Make your advanced directive and think about it. And you can document it. That's very important. And you can have a lawyer certify it, and you can have it notarized. But then if you put it in the safety deposit box, nothing will happen. You've got to share it with your family. Most important. And if you have 6 kids and 2 of them don't have the guts to let you go, then you make sure that Bob, the one who would for sure say, let him go, is your proxy. So it's important to actually have the one person who will make the decision for you if you can't. But they're not there at the emergency room a lot of times.
Right.
So the truth is, you got to get them all on board. How important is a geriatrician, hospice, or palliative care nursing to be comfortable with the prospect of their own dying process.
Hmm. Well, that's an important
question.
Yeah,
it's very important.
Yeah.
But here's the last one of the questions that I have. The most important principle in allowing a person to die is choose the best answer. Okay, Lori? Avoidance of artificial hydration or avoidance of artificial nutrition?
We'll ask the audience.
Nutrition or hydration? We've got nutrition running through the audience here. And the answer is, there was a 500-pound guy who went on a 2-year fast and was still alive. All he drank was water and electrolytes. It isn't nutrition that keeps you alive. If you quit the hydration, it's 10 days. And so what happens is they hit the emergency room. The first thing the ER does is start a big IV fluid, running in full speed. And then they get to the floor. It's a stroke. We don't know what's going to happen. He's lost his swallow. He's lost all of the rest of this. Start a feeding tube. And the fluids go through the IV end of the nutrition through the feeding tube. Yeah, back in the day when Sir William Osler wrote an article about how people died in 1905. Am I right on this, Gackle? I think it is. He found that most people went out gently. There were like 5% of the people who went out either excited and high or struggling and severely miserable. But they died a lot easier and a lot quicker in the natural way that we died, with our own endorphins kicking in, when we didn't have IV fluids. I mean, we didn't have IV fluids until transfusion started in the 20s. And then they decided it wasn't really the blood that is so important. And, of course, it's a lot easier to give IV fluids and not have to get the transfusion reactions covered. So fluids really did begin in World War I. And so since that time, now people go out, you know, they drag on and on. And the studies by the support study in the late 90s showed that even if you had an advanced directive, you get to the hospital, and many people died suffering. 50% of them said that they were in pain more than 50% of the time. Hmm. And they're certainly dying, in the ICU. They shouldn't be in the ICU. They should be in the most comfortable, open bed, families surrounding them like a campfire. But that's not what happened in the 97 support study. So I think with hospice and with palliative care, we're doing a lot better than we did before. We're still not doing very good.
Let's talk a little bit about writing and the journey that you've been on and how writing is sort of interwoven with it, which benefits all of us. You know, some people write and don't necessarily publish, and that has great benefits as well. You have an essay about the value of writing.
Yes.
Would you read for us again, please?
During the South Dakota Festival of Books, I listened to a group of 5 successful novelists discussing the art of writing and what they gained from creating those words. They all seemed to agree with journalist Malcolm Gladwell, who said that it takes some talent, but more importantly, about 10,000 hours of practice to become good at anything. They each also said that writing has given them joy and humor, an understanding about life, and a sense about meaning. Hearing all this, I reflected on how much room I have for improvement in my own writing. On the other hand, I realized my compositions are not for a novel, but for self-help. And the goal of my last book, Life's Final Season, is to help people during their aging and dying process. As opposed to a novel, my writing has a different purpose. I also thought how therapeutic my writing has been for me since my cancer diagnosis. There's a lot out there about writing as therapy. Orthopedic surgeon David Hanscom, in his book Back in Control, provides for us a writing method to help people in chronic pain. He advises those in pain to write down any random thoughts for 10 to 30 minutes once or twice a day for at least several months. Hanscom reports the theory that when pain becomes chronic, the signals change from damaged pain actively, the damaged pain actively in one part of the brain, to an emotional fear and anxiety pain response in a different part of the brain. Hanscom asserts that the daily writing exercise truly helps people break the pain cycle when nothing else will help, particularly surgery. Professor Gilly Bolton also recommends a daily writing program for chronic pain. She says not to worry about grammar, style, or spelling, and advises starting by unloading and dumping negative thoughts, followed with expressive and explorative writing about any topic. She suggests focusing on the writing without distraction, finding time to do it once or twice daily. Do it for yourself or not for others. Her contention, writing helps us illuminate our own suppressed feelings, thereby helping people deal with chronic pain, depression, and the miseries of life. I truly hope my book helps caregivers and people who are aging and dying, but my writing has had the better help for me, helping me cope with a deadly diagnosis. A daily writing exercise may just help you too. So that's my writing encouragement. It has been a huge help for me.
Yeah.
And whether there is any published results from anybody's writing doesn't matter. It's the writing that matters. I think that's what most people do. They write and they feel better and they go, ooh, I got to keep doing this.
Right. Do you write with a pen and paper or are you a keyboard guy? And does it matter?
I don't think it matters. Yeah. But I will say this, that my dear adoptive sister, Jeannie Cecil, is starting to write a book. And she has had bipolar problems. And I'm going to write a little bit in her book. Maybe we'll see. And I'm just so excited that she's helping because she struggles with these issues and she's really with it, intelligent, I mean, extremely smart, much smarter than I am, woman. And she said, I'm writing it in a notebook. Should I be typing it on the typewriter? How do you do it, Rick? And I said, any way you can get her done. I kind of think you'd be better off writing it in a notebook and then typing and editing as you go. And because when I type, I'm kind of typing away and then I read it again and I edit it 10 times.
Right.
And every time I read it, you know, you change it and then you go, oh my God, how did I write that and leave that mistake in it?
Right, but you're writing for publication.
But when
don't worry about that.
No punctuation needed.
Right. Is that a process for you? I mean, do you have a special space that you do your writing?
I do.
You know, a special notebook? Like, tell us a little bit about, take us to that space with you.
Okay.
So I
have a good computer. I use Word. I make sure that I save it in a notebook on the computer. I often will send it off to someone else to read so that I also have a Google saved version.
Yeah.
And I back up my computer periodically. The way I write is I go to Cook's Kitchen in Brookings, which is a local mom-and-pop restaurant that serves eggs and coffee that keeps coming, and the coffee is Norwegian style, which means that it's a little bit brown. And you can drink a lot of it. And then I'll try to squeeze an hour or 2 hours in now that I have more time. Sometimes I get there at 8 in the morning and I leave at noon.
Right. Now that you have a little bit of flexibility.
And I've had a lot of coffee, so I generally tip them profusely for the amount of coffee they've poured. You know, it's just poor waitress. But they love me I feel loved there.
Yeah. Feel the love, do some writing, get your exercise, talk to your family about your final wishes.
Yeah.
Get smart about living and dying and having those conversations. And listen.
And listen.
Those are...
Let go of the fear of all of this. I mean, we're all going to die. Why worry one moment about the panic of death? It'll come. Don't be afraid.
All right. Do the Snoopy dance.
Do the Snoopy dance every day.
Dr. Racone, the book is called Life's Final Season, a treasure to have you here with us today. And in the future, you can hear Dr. Holm on SDPB Radio on Thursdays. You can see him on Thursday nights on SDPB TV and find him at a book signing near you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Lori. It's a great pleasure and an honor.